a Spanish Jewish scholar of the Middle Ages by the name of Chasdai Halevi once wrote a letter to Moses Maimonides inquiring as to whether a Gentile, a non-Jew, could ever reach a state of blessedness and have a share in the world to come. Maimonides, the foremost Jewish scholar, philosopher of the Middle Ages, replied in a lengthy responsum in which he summarized the whole subject by saying, "Know that the Lord desires the heart, and that the intention of the heart is the measure of all things." The intention of the heart is the measure of all things. And no truer words were ever spoken. And Maimonides might also have added, the intention of the heart is also the measure of all human worth. What really is the intrinsic merit of a man? By what standard shall we measure a man? I mean all men, not merely the exceptional and the great, the ideal, the saint, the famous man, but I mean all men, including the average man. The unpublicized man, the man who lives out his life in a rather small and limited circle of family and friends, who is engaged in some rather average and sometimes very humble occupation, earning a modest living. By what standard shall we evaluate him and all other men? By what standard, too, shall the man himself evaluate himself? For that is even more important than the value which others place upon him. For a man always lives with himself. And if he once comes to the conclusion, if he once comes to think of himself as of little worth, worthless, then that man is completely lost, completely destroyed. Now sometimes, quite unconsciously, in judging others and ourselves, we confuse the success of a man with the worth of a man. Just as we often fail to distinguish between the price of a thing and the value of that same thing. We see successful men in business or any other walk of life, and quickly, we are inclined to attribute to them some substantial worth. They are worthy because they are successful. Actually, of course, there exists no essential relationship between the two. Success is not the infallible test or gauge of character. Character and achievement do not always follow one another as cause and effect. Of course, a man's intelligence and training and ability are tremendous factors in achieving success, whatever one's chosen field may be. But there is much else. There are many other things which enter into a man's personal success or failure. And the successful man is inclined to overlook that, not to think of it, because it does not feed his pride, his self-satisfaction. There is chance. There is the element of opportunity which favors one man and may bypass another man. Just as there are accidents, unforeseen accidents, which may kill the strongest and the healthiest, so there is chance and luck and opportunity which may advance one man and may retard another, which may make one man and break another. You and I know of many a failure who deserve to be very successful, and of many so-called successful men who deserve to be failures. You and I know of the vast fortunes which some so-called successful men have accumulated through fraud, through corrupt methods, through piracy and exploitation, or such vast fortunes may represent simply the unearned inheritance of children who had been wise in the selection of their parents and who in all other things are considerably stupid. On the other hand, you and I know of men who remain poor or what people call unsuccessful because they were strong enough to withstand certain temptations and to withhold their hand from corruption. No, financial success is not always a true measure of a man's real worth. Nor is popular acclaim, for that matter. Now, most men never get into the spotlight to receive any popular applause. Their lives are far removed from the stage upon which the spotlight is cast. But even those who do move in a world and in a situation where they're seen and noted and spoken of, how often is their popular acclaim due not to real worth or inner merit, but to certain fortuitous circumstances? They happen to come at the right moment, in the right situation, where the confluence of circumstances favored them. Or they were shrewd enough, or they were unscrupulous enough to manipulate these circumstances at hand to their own advantage. This is especially true of men in political life. Many of our acclaimed political heroes have feet of clay. Nevertheless, they evoke from the uninformed populace loud praise and hero worship. They forget that when the mob applauds a political hero, it is really very often applauding itself, its own inner commonplace banality, its own cheapness, and its own weakness. The greatest danger which lies in wait for men in public life is that they may come to evaluate their service to their community or to their country, and accordingly also their own worth, in terms of the manner of their reception by the populace. It is recorded of a famous Athenian statesman who one day addressed a great throng of people in Athens. At one part of his oration, he was loudly applauded by the crowd. Whereupon he turned to one of his friends and said, "What have I said amiss that the people are applauding me?" And just as financial success and popular recognition are no true measures of a man's worth, neither is the mere accumulation of knowledge or learning. Now, most men never move into that small, select group of the intellectual elite. Many men and women have not had the advantages of much book learning or of higher education, but their worth to themselves and to their group and to their circle, in no way is diminished by this fact. The sheer amassing of learning and information is in itself no evidence of moral excellence. It is only when one's learning becomes ethically compulsive and socially dynamic, when knowledge is translated into wisdom and wisdom into loving kindness, it is only then that it becomes true manifestation of real human worth. Our rabbis had an apt phrase for the pundit who is loaded with a lot of learning, a lot of erudition, but who is innocent of social deeds, of socially beneficent acts. They had an apt simile for that kind of a man. They called him Chamor, Nosei Sfarim, a donkey that hauls books. It was a great Christian mystic, Thomas a Kempis, who said that on Judgment Day, we shall not be asked what we have read, but what we have done. What then is the true measure of a man's worth? If you will permit me, I will give you my own opinion. There are three things by which I always like to judge a man, if I'm ever tempted to judge him. Best thing is not to judge anybody. To to judge ourselves, and that not too often because we might get discouraged. But and in some moment I'm inclined to ask myself, what is this human being really worth? There are three gauges which I employ. Three which are in a way really one. And they all have to do with what Maimonides called the intention of the heart, the inner impulses, the inner attitudes, the inner dispositions. In the first place, I ask myself, has that man a real open mind? Not a great mind, but an open mind. Is he willing and eager to learn? Not how much has he learned, but does he really think of life as a quest, as a pilgrimage? Is he really ready to welcome and to accept truth, whatever direction it might come? Or is his mind shut tight by prejudice or bigotry or sloth or indolence? Is he really stubbornly refusing to accept a new idea which may put him to the inconvenience of revising his old ideas and his old conceptions? Is he ready to surrender, if necessary, his peace of mind in order to consider a new idea? Is he ready to complicate his life by new problems? And having found a new truth, is he ready to be true to it? Has he the strength of conviction to live by it and for it? Such a man, regardless in what station in life he may be, a banker or a busboy, it makes no difference. Such a man is of golden worth. He need not be a scholar, he need not be a rarely gifted man. He may be a very humble man, but he's of sterling worth, of golden worth. If he has an honest mind, he's of the chosen children of God, an honest mind. For with such men, mankind can move forward. Civilization can advance. With such men, there are no roadblocks in society. Such men will never be recruits for the agitator, for the social conspirator. Such a man will never be a blind tool in the hands of the enemies of society. He has an open mind. He may be a poor man, but to me he's a man of tremendous worth. And lacking the open mind, he may be a millionaire. To me, he has no worth at all. And my second gauge of a man's worth, next to the open mind, is the stout heart. Is that man strong in adversity? Has he the stamina and the fortitude to rise after he had been thrice beaten down by misfortune? Has he the strength to endure defeat and not to yield to it? Does he remain steadfast and loyal? Does he abide by whatever he believes in? By whatever he believes in, does he abide by it? In spite of all the taunts of men and in spite of all the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. That's a test of a man's real worth. My dear friends, life has a way of sending its arrows deep into the deepest soul of every human being. Life brings to all of us, sooner or later, pain, loss, bereavement, frustration of purpose, unfulfilled ambitions, unrealized hopes. And the older one gets, the more one realizes how few are the cherished dreams of our lives, which ever entirely or even partially come true. A teacher of mine many years ago told me of a famous rabbi who said to a group of his disciples, words which so plumb the depth of universal human experience that they have remained with me these many years. This old rabbi said, when I was young, I thought that I could reform the whole world. I was so strong, I felt so strong, and so full of ambition, so full of confidence. I thought I could reform the whole world. A little later in life, I realized that it would be enough if I were to improve my own little community. But I soon found that I could not do even that. As I grew older, I said to myself, if I could but improve the lives of the members of my own family, I would be a fortunate man. But I found that even that I could not do. And now that I am old, I say to myself, it would be a wonderful thing if I could only improve myself. But even that I find tremendously, incredibly difficult. A real measure of worth, dear friends, is how a human being reacts to the inevitable limitations, disappointments, disabilities of life. Does it grow bitter? Does it grow resentful? Does it crumple? Become dispirited? Or does he, like some of those rare herbs and flowers, which yield up their sweetness and their fragrance only after they are crushed? That's a real test of a man's worth. And my final gauge of a man's worth, next to his open mind, next to his stout heart, is his helping hand. How is this man using the gifts of his life, his talents, his position, his power? How is he using it? Little or more? Little or more? How is he using whatever he has? For himself alone? Or also for others? Does he go through life with a hand that only grasps, but only takes, holds, accumulates? Or does he go through life with a hand which also gives and upholds and uplifts? And again, I'm not thinking of the great or the rich or the powerful, nor am I thinking exclusively of charity. I am thinking whether this man's whole life is a dedication to goodness in life. Every man, whatever his circumstance may be, within his family, within a circle of friends and acquaintances, every human being can or cannot contribute, does or does not contribute to the graciousness and the kindliness of human existence. Every human being may or may not, by his unselfishness, ease the burden of others, bring lightness into dark corners, and cheer and comfort tired hearts. In his famous debate with Douglas, Abraham Lincoln said, "There is an eternal struggle in life, and that is the real issue. That is the issue that will continue in this country when these poor tongues of Judge Douglas and myself shall be silent. It is the eternal struggle between these two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. They are the two principles that have stood face to face from the beginning of time and will ever continue to struggle. The one is the common right of humanity, and the other the divine right of kings. It is the same principle in whatever shape it develops itself. It is the same spirit that says, you work and toil and earn bread, and I'll eat it. No matter in what shape it comes, whether from the mouth of a king who seeks to bestride the people of his own nation and live by the fruit of their labor, or from one race of men as an apology for enslaving another race, it is the same tyrannical principle. I want to know on what side of this eternal struggle that particular human being stands. I don't care what he has. I don't care what his position in life has been. I want to know whether he's on the side of those who fight for the good and the true and the try to help, on the side of the angels in this eternal struggle, or on the side of those who are indifferent or those who may belong to the forces of Satan. Has he a helping hand? In our synagogues this Sabbath, we began the reading of the book of Exodus and the story of Moses, the greatest figure in human history. Now, Moses was raised in the palace of the Pharaoh, the king's palace. He was surrounded by all the luxury and the wealth, the splendor and the pleasures of the Egyptian court. And he could have remained there, and men would have called him a very successful man. Vayigdal Moshe, says the Bible, when Moses grew up, he didn't remain in the palace. Vayetze Elechov, he went out to his brothers in the slave pens, where they were engaged in forced labor, building the fortresses for the Pharaoh under the whip of the taskmaster, this prince who had the world in his hand, left all that he had, Vayetze Elechav, Vayar Besivlotam, and saw the heavy labor that they were under. And he cast his lot in with them. And thereafter, his life was one of struggle, of suffering. The very people whom he redeemed from slavery turned against him, sought to kill him. For years he wandered through a terrible wilderness with a host of discontented erstwhile slaves. And he died a lonely man in some unknown grave, somewhere outside of the promised land. What was the worth of this man, Moses, to himself, to his people, to mankind. What determined his worth? Simply this, which for lack of a better term, I call the helping hand. He wanted to be where people needed him, or where he thought he was needed. Wherever there was weakness, he wanted to give of his strength. That's what makes a man worthy. A man doesn't have to be a Moses, a leader of men. In the humblest walk of life, a man can demonstrate the same quality of wanting to be a radiant source of helpfulness. And so, good friends, we are inclined to measure your neighbor or yourself. Do not judge him by the number of things which he has accumulated, by the wealth which he has amassed, by the popular esteem in which he is held, by the harvest of knowledge which he may have garnered. Judge him, judge yourself. Judge him rather by these three standards or criteria. All of them in the realm of the intent. One of the great rabbis said that he who intended to do a good deed, but was forcibly prevented, that man is given credit as if he had done it. The intentions of the heart. Judge a man by these three things. The open mind. The stout heart. The helping hand. Give me such a man, and I'll say of him, verily, he is a child of God. He's a man of great worth. He can stand in the court of the king.